In the U.S., vote counting continues in a few key states as President Donald Trump and his contender Joe Biden both claim to be ahead in the election. The European Union urges Israel to cease demolishing Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and withdraw its threat of demolishing Palestinian schools. Also coming up, the Greek government orders a nationwide lockdown for 3 weeks to help contain a resurgence of COVID-19 cases. Welcome to World News. We're live from our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, Americans are grappling with anxiety, fear and optimism as votes in the presidential election continue to be counted with the outcome still unclear. The last polls closed more than 24 hours ago. However, the race is still too close to be called. Democratic candidate Joe Biden has so far secured 264 electoral votes, while incumbent President Donald Trump has grabbed 214. A candidate needs to win 270 to become president. The two are trailing each other in Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Georgia, which are crucial swing states. Biden says he is getting enough votes to win the White House.
And now, after a long night of counting, it's clear that we're winning enough states to reach 270 electoral votes needed to win the presidency. I'm not here to declare that we've won, but I am here to report when the count is finished, we believe we will be the winners.
Biden added that he has the majority of popular votes all across the U.S. and that the majority will continue to grow. However, Trump claims there have been, quote, surprise ballot dumps in the states where he was leading. Trump, without offering any evidence, claimed his votes started to magically disappear after surprise ballots started being counted. He accused the Democrats of trying to steal the vote. The president's campaign has requested an immediate recount of votes in Wisconsin. It has also filed a lawsuit to halt the counting in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia. Let's bring in our correspondent in Miami, Ronnie Carvello, for the latest. Ronnie, welcome. Is there any update on these handful of swing states that are remaining?
Unfortunately, no. Today's news is yesterday's news. So no much to add from since yesterday. Now it's about 8 o'clock in the morning here. And I went to bed last night thinking that when I wake up this morning, we're going to have a president, and we don't have yet. But what I can tell is by noon today, Eastern Standard Time, New York time, we may have a better scenario response, because Georgia, especially Georgia, promised to deliver the remaining ballots by today, by noon. So, and right now it's a very narrow margin of the difference between both candidates. Trump is ahead of Biden, but the Biden camp believes that they can turn these things around. So by noon, we may have something. Arizona, what they said, and the reason why they're taking so long, because since yesterday in the morning, that was not updated. What they're saying that they are putting all the votes together so they can release at once. So, and they promised that by tomorrow. But probably they may have something today as well. Not only because it's a need, but because also Trump is putting a lot of pressure on the voters.
Right. And on that note, Ronnie, after months of protests about racism and police brutality, with this uncertain election outcome and the statements made by the president, is there a fear that there could be further unrest?
Oh, definitely. But I like to, on top of that, I like to add something. The protests that we have seen from the Trump camp so far, I will talk about the Biden camp as well, the supporters of Biden. But as far as the Trump camp, what I can say is that depends where. For example, in Philadelphia or in Georgia, the protests are asking to stop counting. No, you don't need to count any more votes. In Arizona, they are asking to keep counting. So all depends on the situation of where Trump is heading. If he's losing, they want to stop. He wants to stop the vote, the counting of votes. If he is losing, they want to continue the counting of votes. So, but in the Biden's camp, the movement is more is being taken over by the Black Lives Matter movement, and of course the police brutality that we haven't seen in the years. Many years now, of course, it tend to increase, especially on those moments of uncertainty. And last night we had a few movements, some few protests, we may have seen, we may going to see many of them in the next couple of days.
And you know, Ronnie, it can't be good for America's image when the U.S. president himself says that the election in America was rigged and talking about widespread voter fraud.
Well, it's Trump being Trump. Of course, what we heard so far from people who got some very selective information from the White House, and that Trump is very worried about losing this election, and losing is not very welcome for him. He doesn't like to lose anything. And of course, that is a shame, what he's saying. But I also can tell that many Republicans already said that it's important to count the votes, every vote counts, and they don't see any fraud. So we have not only elected officials saying that, Marco Rubio here in Florida, he said something like yesterday that counting votes is not a fraud. So that's very important, because it was the first elected official to say something that goes against Trump. And also the leader of the majority in the Senate, Mitchell, said that all the votes needs to be counted. Former governors, Republican governors, said the same thing. So I believe that when we got the results, this is what I believe, when we got the final results, and if Trump is not the win of this election, I'm sure that the Republican Party will come to him and say, hey, that's it, it's over, it's done, so we have to move on. Because then that's it. They are those people, those senators and representatives will be elected, and they have to, you know, take care of themselves as well.
Okay, Ronnie, thank you very much indeed. Ronnie Garavello there, our correspondent, joining us from Miami. Now, what happens in the U.S. election will play a vital role in the next 4 years of U.S. foreign policy, in particular when it comes to Iran and China. Already since taking the helm in 2016, Donald Trump has managed to intensify tensions with both nations through his aggressive policies. But for whoever sits in the White House next, what will their policies resemble in the next 4 years?
The outcome of the US election will of course play a vital role in how the US progresses over the next 4 years, from the handling of the COVID-19 virus to the racial inequality protests that are part of everyday life in the country. But what about the Americans' relations with other countries, in particular Iran and China? For a start, Iran has made it very clear that the outcome of the election will have no effect on how Iran views the United States. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, made this very clear in a recent speech. However, at the end of the day, either Trump or Biden will one day take the seat at the White House, and the topic of Iran will no doubt come up. Yet as things stand, Iran has seen what Trump is capable of when dealing with Iran, including the assassination of top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, as well as Trump pulling out of the JCPOA and imposing sanctions on the nation, which has raised the speculation that Iran could see Biden as a more promising candidate as president. Backing up what was said by the leader, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has also pointed out that it's not important what slogans and promises are made before the election by either Trump or Biden, but what is actually acted on after winning the election, clearly showing that Iran is cautious of more false promises by the Americans. It hence raises the question as to why exactly Iran should trust the United States over the next 4 years, even if the Americans do initially show some kind of diplomatic outreach.
Well, I think it is quite clear that there is absolutely no real reason for Iran to trust the United States in any way, shape, or form, no matter who of the two major candidates right now wins the elections. Of course, we have seen that Donald Trump is more of the loose cannon, let's say, more of a rabid dog, if you want to say it that way, in terms of diplomacy towards the Islamic Republic of Iran in particular, especially regarding the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and the general approach towards Iran in regards to the sanctions, of course, and the destruction of the JCPOA agreement.
With Biden likely to emulate some of the steps taken by Obama in signing the JCPOA, for Trump, the situation is different. What is clear is that should he wish to show any sign of improving ties with Iran, then he'll have to take on a whole new approach. However, as mentioned, Iran has clearly stated that it's not interested in dealing with the US, hence potentially opening the door to alternative options for Iran.
And the next 4 years hold more dilemmas for the United States, regardless of who takes the keys to the Treasury Department. Trump's legacy has so far brought about a trade war with China, an emerging Cold War with Russia, potential conflict with North Korea, and failed diplomacy with Iran. So could the next term hence see a continuation of this, or will the next president seek to change the US foreign policy for the better? What happens next could be largely determined by China, as the world's second largest economy and fast approaching the top spot. Ties between the US and China have truly shown a sweet and sour side over the last 4 years. But could the US relationship with Iran lead China to step in as the Islamic Republic's global partner? And if so, how will Washington react?
Over the last 4 years, Trump's relations with global nations has truly resembled a pendulum, with his rhetoric and feelings towards the countries and their leaders swinging left to right in a worrying bipolar fashion. China, for one, has seen this behaviour, with Trump initially holding good ties with the Chinese president Xi Jinping. However, the bromance soon turned sour over trade and allegations of the coronavirus being made in China, leaving the Chinese now hoping for Biden to win. Yet much like Iran, China have little optimism that much will change under Biden. However, there is a flip side to the coin. Much in the same way that Iran has been able to develop under its own steam through economic sanctions, some in China claim that Trump winning could benefit China's growth, as Trump leads the US down the wrong path, hence paving the way for China to blossom. An example of the growth that China has been able to enjoy is the relationship that it has with Iran, with the Chinese and Iranians having penned a draft accord that could see the countries agree to a 25-year trade deal, which could spell problems for the West as the two nations strike a deal that could see both China and the Iranian economies prosper. But should the US hence not act fast when it comes to Iran, could the Sino-Iranian deal leave the US empty-handed?
I think that, again, no matter who wins, at this point, I think it is already too late. I think it would be a major mistake for Iran to think like, oh, based on maybe who wins, we could revert our policy in regards to signing this treaty, this 25-year treaty with China. Or if Iran were to say maybe we should restart our negotiations regarding, you know, nuclear energy, nuclear power, and sign a new treaty with the United States. I think this would be a major step backwards, especially when we have seen that there are a lot of people, a lot of nations, even allies of the United States, even NATO member states in Europe, for example, who oppose the warmongering policy by the United States, finally, after so many decades, have decided that the United States has gone too far.
As much as the United States claims that it is the global power, the international political and economic arena is fast changing. And with new powers and partnerships emerging, the next US president has a tough 4 years ahead, whoever that might be.
Elsewhere, the European Union has called on Israel to cease demolishing Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank. In a statement, the bloc also urged the regime to lift its threat to demolish 52 Palestinian schools in the occupied territories, including those co-funded by the EU. The statement came 2 days after Israeli bulldozers razed to the ground an entire village in the Jordan Valley, leaving some 80 Palestinians homeless. The statement said half of those made homeless were children. It added that the large-scale demolition confirms once again, quote, the regrettable trend of confiscations and demolitions since the beginning of the year. Israeli authorities usually demolish homes in the occupied territory, citing different pretexts. According to the Palestinian Information Center, the regime forces have destroyed at least 218 Palestinian homes so far this year. And in other news, Europe is witnessing a surge in coronavirus cases and deaths, prompting several governments in Europe to implement strict lockdown measures to slow the spread of the pandemic. Poland registered over 27,000 new coronavirus infections, breaking its daily record. Greece also announced a three-week lockdown due to a surge in daily COVID-19 cases. So far, 673 people have died from the disease in Greece. Elsewhere in Europe, Russia said the coronavirus situation in the country was alarming after the country reported a near daily record of some 20,000 new cases. Ukraine, Germany, and the Czech Republic have all reported new daily records of infections. Several European countries, including France, Germany, and England, have already imposed new month-long lockdowns to combat the virus resurgence. The European Union, meanwhile, has warned that the economy will not return to the pre-coronavirus levels before 2023.
The depth of the recession in 2020 and the speed of the recovery in 2021 and 2022 are expected to vary widely across member states. Nearly half of our member states are not expected to recover their pre-pandemic level of GDP by the end of 2022.
In a news conference in Brussels, the EU's Economic Affairs Commissioner, Paolo Gentiloni, said a recovery in Europe's economy has been interrupted by the second wave of the pandemic. He added that next year the Eurozone economy will grow much lower than what was predicted in July. The coronavirus outbreak has been a major shock for the global economies. As a result, unemployment rates have increased in many countries. The United States has reported yet another daily record in coronavirus infections, registering nearly 100,000 new cases. That's according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Data also show the country suffered more than 1,100 new coronavirus-related deaths in 24 hours. The U.S. is the world's hardest-hit country by the pandemic in terms of both infections and fatalities. Nearly 9.5 million people have so far been diagnosed with the disease there. The country's death toll now stands at over 233,000. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, Filippo Grandi, said many refugees live within communities rather than camps, where they are additionally impacted by the pandemic of poverty. Many are informal workers whose livelihoods have been thrown into disarray. This has led to rising demand for assistance, even in countries that have offered refugees sanctuary for decades. He expressed concern about the pandemic's impact on women and girls, as illustrated by increasing reports of gender-based violence, adding that refugee girls cannot return to school without catch-up learning strategies or water, sanitation, and hygiene programs. We have prepared for you an article which appeared on the front page of UN.org website under the heading UNHCR Chief Says for World's 80 Million Displaced International Aid Life-Saving. Please stay with us for more of UN.org's article. Delegates discussed tackling ever-proliferating humanitarian crises amid an unprecedented emergency. Filippo Grandi, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, told the UN Third Committee on Social, Humanitarian and Cultural on Tuesday, 3rd of November, international collaboration and a sustained, adequately funded response are needed to ensure the world's 80 million displaced persons are protected from the COVID-19 pandemic and its lingering socio-economic aftermath. Filippo Grandi said, although the pandemic was unlike any of the agency had experienced in the 7 decades of its existence, it galvanized into action, helping host countries step up their response by strengthening access to water, to sanitation and health, and addressing challenges relating to mental health and gender-based violence. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, stressed as a result, major outbreaks have been avoided in refugee settings. However, he said many refugees live within communities rather than camps, where they are additionally impacted by the pandemic of poverty. He added, "This is why we will not relent in strengthening our preparedness." Whilst donors have mobilized funds to assist the forcibly displaced, he expressed concern about countries which enforce travel restrictions that block channels for asylum seekers and urged states to not violate their international obligations relating to non-refoulement. He emphasized international assistance is life-saving. Hailing the extraordinary solidarity that led to an influx of $4.5 billion in donations to the agency this year, Filippo Grandi pointed out that such generous humanitarian assistance is outstripped by the escalating number of refugees set in motion by the world's continuously multiplying conflicts. Grandi called on the UN Security Council to redouble its efforts to resolve political crises by reaching consensus on humanitarian issues. While safe, orderly repatriation is the most desirable option, it can only take place when peace prevails. Filippo Grandi called on states to provide resettlement assistance as Germany and Canada have done, adding, "I cannot hide my disappointment at the low levels of resettlement." In the ensuing dialogue held virtually, several delegates spoke out to share their experiences with refugee settlement, with some, including from Syria, China and Ethiopia, noting that 85% of the burden of supporting refugees falls upon developing countries' shoulders. Others, including the United States representative and the observer for the European Union, pointed out that a disproportionate share of contributions to UNHCR were borne by a limited number of donors and encouraged the agency to seek out non-traditional sources to overcome its funding gap. Filippo Grandi said the COVID-19 pandemic demonstrates the challenges of such scale, much like the climate emergency, poverty, inequality and forced displacement require collaborative efforts to support the most vulnerable. The magnitude of the present emergency is unlike any that UNHCR has faced in 7 decades of providing underground assistance. Nonetheless, he said, the agency acted quickly using an innovative approach to help host countries step up their response, including by strengthening access to water, sanitation and health, and by addressing issues relating to mental health, stigma, and gender-based violence. He stressed, as a result, major outbreaks have been avoided in refugee settings. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, Filippo Grandi, said many refugees live within communities rather than camps, where they are additionally impacted by the pandemic of poverty. Many are informal workers whose livelihoods have been thrown into disarray. This has led to rising demand for assistance even in countries that have offered refugees sanctuary for decades. He expressed concern about the pandemic's impact on women and girls, as illustrated by increasing reports of gender-based violence, adding that refugee girls cannot return to school without catch-up learning strategies or water, sanitation, and hygiene programs. Turning to humanitarian assistance, Filippo Grandi welcomed a prompt response by donors to funding needs specifically for the pandemic. As much as 62% of UNHCR's $745 million appeal has already been funded, and more donations will be needed in 2021. However, he stressed, humanitarian assistance alone is not enough. Stronger social safety net programs and vaccination campaigns must be undertaken to mitigate the plight of the forcibly displaced and to relieve pressure in societies where they live. He welcomed the early involvement of the World Bank and the African Development Bank, which was a core element in the Global Compact on Refugees, affirmed by the UN General Assembly in 2018. He assured the mobilization of these resources is transforming the response to forced displacements. Filippo Grandi said at the Global Refugee Forum held in Geneva, Switzerland last December, as many as 1,400 pledges were made. However, the underlying causes of displacement, including conflict, remain unresolved. He expressed concern about multiplying conflicts because people fled their homes, including in Mozambique, Cote d'Ivoire, Yemen, Nicaragua, and the Central Sahel, where a complex situation led to the displacement of 650,000 people in 2020 alone. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, is also deeply concerned about the escalating conflict between the Republic of Azerbaijan and Armenia, which can displace thousands of people in a fragile region. Filippo Grandi stressed that for the 80 million people who were forced to leave their homes, international assistance is life-saving. He called on states which tightened freedom of movement during the pandemic to uphold their international obligations and respect the principle of non-refoulement. While states such as Uganda have found ways to take in refugees from the Democratic Republic of Congo and at the same time ensure precautionary measures are taken, as many as 67 states have not. He reiterated the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees' readiness to offer them assistance in tackling the complex challenges posed by mixed flows of refugees and migrants. Addressing these problems by reducing humanitarian assistance to those undertaking dangerous journeys, including by sea or by externalizing asylum response, is not appropriate. He stressed such measures taken in reaction to xenophobic rhetoric places refugees in unnecessary danger and threatens the global practice of dramatically needed asylum. While safe, voluntary, and dignified repatriation is the most desirable option, Filippo Grandi said it is available only when peace prevails. He expressed disappointment at the low level of integration and resettlement in third countries and hoped they would increase. Highlighting measures taken by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees to promote diversity within the agency, including the launch of a race equity review, he called a recent debate held with refugees who responded to the pandemic as doctors and community workers in their host communities and said their inspiring example counters the toxic narrative that often depicts them as a threat and a burden. In the ensuing dialogue, delegates shared national experiences and posed questions to the High Commissioner for Refugees. Many acknowledged the magnitude of the world's displacement crisis, with several underscoring the importance of burden and responsibility sharing in addressing the needs of refugees and persons of concern. Among them was a representative of Lebanon, who said her country hosts more than 1 million displaced Syrians, amounting to one-third of the country's population. 88% of them live below the extreme poverty line, compared to 50% in 2019. Lebanon now hosts the largest number of displaced persons per capita, offering a global public good. Guided by a human rights-based approach, its health system is available to all, regardless of status or nationality. But the country needs urgent help. Pointing to the sharp currency depreciation, the massive fallout from the financial crisis, COVID-19, and the tragic events around the 4th of August blast, she said, Lebanon cannot bear the brunt of the displacement crisis. Meanwhile, the representative of Syria encouraged the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, to improve its efforts to guarantee the voluntary return of Syrians displaced persons, notably by providing more financial resources and balanced attention to Syria's various regions in its humanitarian activities. He also urged the agency to work with concerned countries to remove their unilateral coercive measures, warning against politicization of humanitarian aid and the return of refugees. He added Syria intends to hold an international conference on refugees on 11th and 12th of November. Stressing that COVID-19 has exacerbated the existing vulnerabilities of refugees, the representative of Turkey described the Global Compact on Refugees as an important tool for burden and responsibility sharing. She said, helping refugees is a moral responsibility. Two-thirds of the world's refugees are internally displaced persons, live in urban areas, and she asked about practical tools that municipalities can put in place, especially during the pandemic. Several delegates described efforts to support displaced persons, with the representative of Pakistan stressing that for 40 years his country has hosted the world's second largest concentration of refugees. Despite limited resources, it has maintained a compassionate approach towards all, even during the pandemic, including by providing equal and unhindered access to public healthcare facilities. Voicing concern about half the world's refugees are children, the representative of the Republic of Azerbaijan said her country hosts one of the world's largest internally displaced person populations. She asserted, the 30-year-long military occupation of the Nagorno-Karabakh region and the adjacent regions of Azerbaijan by Armenia have continued to impede the return of Azerbaijanis internally displaced persons to their land. The representative of the Russian Federation welcomed UNHCR's measures to tackle the COVID-19 pandemic, underscoring the importance that access to vaccines is provided to all under UNHCR's care, particularly in refugee camps. The representative of Russia added that international community must not politicize the issue of the voluntary return of Syrian refugees to their homeland. The representative of South Sudan said his country hosts 1.3 million refugees, 87% of whom live outside the camps and primarily rely on government services provided in response to the COVID-19 health crisis. Along similar lines, the observer for the European Union expressed regret that contributions to UNHCR come from a limited number of donors and advocated for expansion towards non-traditional doctors, whilst the representative of Qatar said her country's contribution to the agency has reached $24 million in 2020, ranking it as the 20th among international donors and the largest among Arab countries. Looking ahead, the representative of Norway on behalf of the Nordic countries asked about the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees' outlook for 2021. Similarly, the representative of the Republic of Korea asked the High Commissioner for Human Rights about ways to encourage all stakeholders to ensure enough space for humanitarian activities and to reduce the risk faced by humanitarian workers on the front lines of displacement. Also speaking were representatives of Italy, Romania, Qatar, Morocco, Iran, Germany, Mali, El Salvador, Switzerland, Cameroon on behalf of the African Group, Mexico, Canada, Ethiopia, Malaysia, China, Thailand, Mali, Afghanistan, Algeria and Venezuela. Whilst responding, Filippo Grandi said, "The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has developed a methodology that it is ready to share with states interested in reconciling pandemic restrictions with channels allowing those seeking asylum to present their claims. It has coordinated its efforts with those of other organizations providing sanitation, health, and shelter under the technical leadership of the World Health Organization, WHO. On resettlement, he said more countries must increase their figures following Canada and Germany's examples. He underscored his concern about the unceasing escalation of hostilities between the Republic of Azerbaijan and Armenia and welcomed efforts by those trying to obtain ceasefires, including the Minsk group. To questions on the biggest post-pandemic challenge, he said he's concerned about the crisis of poverty and interlinked threats to livelihood and access to education. He said the destitution of the displaced and the financial challenges of host countries have the overall effect of limiting education access and increasing sexual and gender-based violence, as well as the threat of exploitation by traffickers and other criminals. He stressed, "We must deploy all tools to counter this." To delegates calling for the burdens of host countries to be recognized, he said that throughout his tenure, he has stressed that the biggest contribution to the global good must be attributed to host countries, adding that the Global Compact on Refugees is built on this premise. Moreover, as many as 1,400 pledges were made by the recently held Global Refugee Forum. Of these, 400 have been implemented or are in the course of being implemented. Whilst the pandemic has inevitably caused delays, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees is keeping close tabs on the rest of the pledges, which will be publicly updated on a dashboard. He reiterated his support for voluntary repatriation, adding that he can work with countries of origin to foster conditions for refugees' safe, voluntary, and sustainable return, only if lasting peace prevails. He said whilst refugees have been included in pandemic response in many countries, this needs to last, adding that they must be given vaccinations when available and must also be included in the social safety net, which is more difficult financially and politically. This concern must be addressed by financial institutions including the World Bank. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has been in contact with them in this regard. Filippo Grandi, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, said the outlook for 2021 is not very positive, as the pandemic will have a lasting economic and social impact. He added that the stateless refugees and even returnees will require additional support. In addition, conflicts seem to be continuously multiplying, leading to ever-escalating numbers of refugees. In this regard, Filippo Grandi called on the UN Security Council to redouble its efforts to reach a consensus on humanitarian issues, which he has not seen it struggle to do in 30 years. Filippo Grandi said he counted on Norway, which will assume its seat on the UN Security Council in 2021, and hoped that all countries will find consensus when discussing the omnibus resolution on United Nations Human Rights Council's work. Filippo Grandi said, "Don't remind me to be apolitical." He added, "You manifest your apolitical character to approve it unanimously."
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The same human activities that drive climate change and biodiversity loss also drive pandemic risk through their impacts on environment, says Julia Conley Ryder in an article published under the heading Seismic Shift in World's Approach to Land Use, Wildlife and Climate Action Needed to Avoid New Era of Pandemics. Study says. Stay tuned for the details, please. Warning that without a seismic shift in how world governments approach the treatment of wildlife, land conservation, and public health, the planet could be entering an era of pandemics. A United Nations-backed report released on Thursday, October 29th, emphasized that the ability to avoid more public health crises like COVID-19 is entirely within the human population's control. Resulting from an urgent virtual workshop attended by 22 experts from around the world, the report by Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services notes that more than 5 new diseases emerge in people each other, and each of these has the potential to develop into global pandemic as the coronavirus did. The novel coronavirus has origins in microbes detected in animal species and is believed to have jumped from an animal to the human population. And human activity has made it dangerously easy for this sort of jump to happen again and again. Scientists estimate that 1.7 million unknown viruses currently exist in mammals and birds, and that up to 850,000 of them could potentially infect humans. There is no great mystery about the cause of the COVID-19 pandemic or of any modern pandemic, said Dr. Peter Daszak, president of EcoHealth Alliance and chair of the IPBES workshop. The same human activities that drive climate change and biodiversity loss also drive pandemic risk through their impacts on our environment. Changes in the way we use land, the expansion and intensification of agriculture, and unsustainable trade production and consumption disrupt nature and increase contact between wildlife. To stop a new era of pandemics from emerging, the experts say governments must work together to stop the exploitation of land and wildlife by profit-driven systems which cause humans and animals to come into close enough contact for pathogens to jump to humans. Unsafe contact between humans and wildlife would be reduced by conservation efforts to protect biodiversity and natural habitats. The promotion of responsible consumption and a reduction in excessive consumption of meat from livestock production and climate action, the report reads. Climate change has been implicated in disease emergence, that is, tick-borne encephalitis in Scandinavia, and will likely cause substantial future pandemic risk by driving movement of people, wildlife, reservoir, and vectors, and a spread of their pathogens in ways that lead to new contact among species. Increased contact among species or otherwise disrupts natural host pathogen dynamics, the IPBES wrote. According to the report, land use change has been linked to the emergence of more than 30% of new diseases in the human population since 1960. Land use change includes deforestation, human settlement in primarily wildlife habitat, the growth of crop and livestock production, and urbanization, the report reads. The solution here seems pretty clear, tweeted Dr. Scott Sampson, executive director of the California Academy of Sciences, in response to the report section on land use change. The study includes a number of suggested reforms which could help to keep pathogens from spreading to humans, including launching a high-level intergovernmental council on pandemic prevention to provide decision-makers with the best science and evidence on emerging diseases, predict high-risk areas, evaluate the economic impact of potential pandemics, and to highlight research gaps. Institutionalizing the One Health approach in national governments to build pandemic preparedness, enhance pandemic prevention programs, and to investigate and control outbreaks across sectors. Ensuring that the economic cost of pandemics is factored into consumption, production, and government policies and budgets. Enabling changes to reduce the types of consumption, globalize agricultural expansion, and trade that have led to pandemics. This could include taxes or levies on meat consumption, livestock production, and other forms of high pandemic risk activities. Reducing zoonotic disease risks in the international wildlife trade through a new intergovernmental health and trade partnership. Reducing or removing high disease risk species in the wildlife trade. Enhancing law enforcement in all aspects of the illegal wildlife trade and improving community education in disease hotspots about the health risks of wildlife trade. And finally, valuing indigenous peoples and local communities' engagement and knowledge in pandemic prevention programs, achieving greater food security and reducing consumption of wildlife. The cost of confronting global public health emergencies after they have arrived, including damage to economies around the world, healthcare costs, and vaccine research, is roughly 100 times what it would cost to prevent another pandemic, the IPBES said. We have the increasing ability to prevent pandemics, but the way we are tackling them right now largely ignores that ability, said Daszak. Our approach has effectively stagnated. We still rely on attempts to contain and control diseases after they emerge, through vaccines and therapeutics. We can escape the era of pandemics, but this requires a much greater focus on prevention in addition to reaction.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
And every day, every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha illallah. Never forget to say La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. The listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. One of the central ideas of the Holy Quran and of certain traditions is the concept of a mu'min, a believer. a true believer? Who is a true believer? What characteristics does this true believer have or show? Or if we want to truly understand that this person is a true believer, what should we look for? In the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, we see that certain characteristics have been mentioned, certain, you know, demeanors have been mentioned, certain ethical traits and characteristics have been mentioned to look out for, or rather not to look out for, not to try and actually implement in our own lives, that inshallah we'll become one of those who can be classified as being a mu'min, as being a believer. In this tradition from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, he mentions one such characteristics or one such trait that a person who is believer, you know, may have. Again, as you've heard many times from me, that these traditions obviously come with conditions. You know, it's not something that you just take one tradition and say, oh, this is it. No, it has to be put together with other traditions in order to get a clearer picture. For example, the intention, what this person is doing, and so on and so forth, plays an important part. And we'll explain that as we mention the tradition. That the Holy Prophet is narrated to have said that the believer is nice and simple. You know, he's not someone who's extravagant. He's not someone who, you know, puts himself out there. He's not someone who shows off, and so on and so forth. Such that he could be mistaken to be stupid because of his simplicity. He's not somebody who wants to show everybody that he's a learned person. You know, he doesn't give answers that, you know, will amaze people. But in reality, the advice that he gives at times, if pondered upon, is extremely deep. You know, the way he dresses may seem to you as, you know, what is this person doing? But for him, it doesn't really matter. Obviously, there are game conditions here and so on and so forth. But he's somebody who lives a simple life. Is somebody who, for example, may find opportunities to make a lot of money. Or he has a lot of money even at times, but he lives a very simple life. So this is where stupidity could come in, is that, okay, this person has so much money, but yet he's living such a simple life. Like, and most of his money, for example, he gives it to charity, but people do not know what he's doing with it. So they say, what is this person doing? Again, this is one possible explanation in this tradition. Where a person is a believer, he's living simply. People are saying, oh, he has so much wealth, he's living like this. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us, first of all, to become a true believer, and secondly, not to judge other people. This is the second part of the tradition, that, you know, we should not judge other people. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more. No more, no more.
The debate.